is like animals, and most of the rest, if not all, were deliberately starved. The vast majority of those detainees have been taken from Gaza, specifically from its northern part. Those are the same people who refused the Israeli eviction orders and stayed rooted in their neighborhoods despite the relentless Israeli aggression. Today was their lifetime moment to reunite with their families and loved ones, a moment they never imagined to be real, as the sunbeams could not sneak through their tiny, dirty cells.
The situation was extremely difficult. One day seemed like 100 million years. The food and drinks available were insufficient to suit the needs of a 2-year-old baby. We were constantly beaten and abused. We can't express anything from the horrible reality we lived in.
The detention experience is harsh and unbearable due to the detainers' torture and the tiny and cramped cells. We spent over 4 months in the jails. We were tortured, subjected to medical mistreatment, and we were starved. Their treatment of us was horrific. As I was freed, I pray that all the prisoners will be released from imprisonment. I hope we can meet again and that they can see their family and loved ones.
With happiness and joy shining in everyone's face here, Palestinian detainees who have been taken unfairly and brutally from their hometowns in Gaza have finally reunited with their loved ones and their families after tasting every sort of torture inside Israeli jails. And their freedom is just the sign of victory they have been always yearning for. Abu Bakr Abid, Khan Yunis.
More Palestinian casualties are reported in the Gaza Strip as the Israeli regime continues to violate the ceasefire agreement with Hamas. At least 2 Palestinian civilians were injured after an Israeli drone strike targeted a bulldozer clearing rubble in central Gaza. 12 Palestinians were also wounded by unexploded ordnance across the war-ravaged territory. The bodies of 25 civilians who were reported missing during the war were recovered from under the rubble. The new fatalities increased the death toll from the Israeli genocide to nearly 48,300, with nearly 111,700 others injured. According to Palestinian sources, Israel has committed 270 ceasefire violations since the truce took effect in January, killing over 100 citizens and injuring dozens. Our Gaza correspondent Moti Abu Musabe joined us earlier with the latest updates on the situation in the besieged Palestinian territory. Let's take a listen.
Right now, as we speak, the Israeli fighter drones are still flying at low altitudes and levels here in Gaza. They are still buzzing over the heads of the Palestinian people in Gaza. And this means clearly that the Israeli occupation forces are still ongoing and persistent with their violations and the brutalities on the ground here. Needless to mention that over the past couple of hours, the Israeli occupation forces targeted a bulldozer that was paving the way for the Palestinian returnees near Al-Mughraqa area, because, as you know, the Israeli forces have destroyed infrastructure on the roads, which complicates the situation on the ground, particularly when it comes to the movement of the Palestinian people, inside Gaza City or between Gaza City and the central area of Gaza. The Israeli forces are still insisting on keeping those violations against the Palestinian people. And even when it comes to Rafah City, which is still the focal point of those Israeli violations, the Israeli tanks continue to shoot at the Palestinian people, attempting to return to their residential areas near Philadelphia Corridor in the southern part of the city. And those attacks and those violations are still constant. Since the very beginning of the implementation of the ceasefire agreement on the ground, the Israeli forces have never stopped their violations against the Palestinian people at all levels, basically when it comes to the humanitarian protocol.
Israeli forces have attacked the homes of recently freed Palestinian abductees in a number of towns and cities across the occupied West Bank. According to local media, Israeli soldiers broke into the house of 43-year-old Musa Diab Shataye, who was released as part of the 6th batch of abductees, forcing his relatives to leave. The father of another abductee from Al-Quds was also summoned by Israeli forces for further interrogation. Earlier, Israeli military raided the homes of other released abductees in Bethlehem, threatening their families against organizing a reception for them. The brutal attacks come after, in recent weeks, Israeli forces conducted raids on the homes of Palestinian abductees scheduled to be released as part of the prisoner exchange agreement with Hamas. Our West Bank correspondent Nika Hamad joined us earlier to bring us up to speed on the latest Israeli atrocities across the occupied Palestinian territory. Let's take a listen.
Despite all of the obstacles and despite all of the restrictions that the IOF has put on receiving those Palestinian free prisoners, and of course on how to receive them and how to celebrate, and the restrictions and the threats that the IOF has made even before they were freed, this was not enough for the IOF forces, as they have raided most of the homes of the freed prisoners and expelled many relatives and family members and community members who were waiting to receive the freed prisoners. For example, a raid has been made on the house of the Palestinian Nael Abed, who was freed towards occupied Al-Quds. He was the only Palestinian who was freed into occupied Al-Quds today in this patch, and announced that there will be no reception. They are banning anyone, even family members, from being inside the house. Anyone who is more than five people inside the house is forbidden.
Tens of thousands of demonstrators have walked through central London to the American embassy to condemn U.S. President Donald Trump's stated plan for Gaza. The march comes around a month after a violent police crackdown on a similar demonstration in the British capital. Saipul Reza has more.
There may be a ceasefire in Gaza, but mass public mobilization demanding justice for Palestinians, like this one in London, is unrelenting.
A ceasefire is just step one. We want a lift off the siege on Gaza. We want the freedom of every Palestinian from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, for the right to return for all Palestinians.
The ceasefire is not the end of the occupation and the subjugation of the Palestinian people. The colonization continues. It started in 1947-48, and we have to end that.
These protests will continue until Palestinians have the right to return to their homeland.
Marching towards the American embassy, the demonstrators direct their anger at the British government for what they call a shamefully subdued reaction to the genocide in Gaza and to Trump's comments.
Among other things, the protesters here are also highlighting continued UK complicity in Israel's actions through its supply of weapons, as well as its military and diplomatic support for the genocidal regime.
But their main target, the U.S. President Donald Trump's stated plan to ethnically cleanse Gaza of its Palestinian inhabitants, a condemnation of that plan delivered on the doorstep of the U.S. Embassy.
It's a morally and politically bankrupt idea, and I think the size of this march, which is a really, really big one, is a measure of how strongly people feel that they want to turn up and protest it.
This is one of the dozens of demonstrations held in Britain since the start of Israel's genocidal war on Palestinians. It comes despite the violent arrest of 77 demonstrators and organizers by police around a month ago, a move which the demonstrators here say was aimed at stifling expressions of solidarity for Palestinians.
They're obviously trying to instill fear in people to try and stop them. I wasn't at that protest, but I was there for Armistice Day, for example, which they tried to ban completely. And the response was the complete opposite. So I'm hoping this time, actually, given what happened last time, that more and more people turn up.
And they did, in their tens of thousands, a clear sign that the Palestine Solidarity Movement is here to stay. Said Bourza, London.
That's why French protesters have taken to the streets of Paris in solidarity with Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. They slammed what they called France's inaction against Israeli genocide. Peter Hume has talked with some of them about their demands.
The fact of forcibly evacuating population is a crime against humanity, and Macron cannot just make nice statement about the fact that it is not possible to deport 2 million people from Gaza, but he must start having sanctions against Israel.
I'm here to fight against Zionism and to pride the value of Palestinians' lives and to make their voice be heard all around the world.
We want a cessation of any economical activity and political support towards the Israeli government in its genocidary campaign. And we want a recognition of the state of Palestine.
First of all, I would like French government to stop funding this genocide by sending arms to Israel, by having company like Starbucks and Coca-Cola and McDonald's, for example. Stop having a government that's fully Zionist. That'll help for sure. And just recognize Palestine as a state as it should be.
Pakistan became the focal point for global solidarity with Palestine as it hosted a two-day international Palestine conference. Delegates from over 15 countries, including political leaders, journalists, and human rights activists, gathered in Islamabad to discuss the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Our correspondent Nasser Kazmi reports from the Pakistani capital.
The two-day international conference dubbed Echo of Palestine kicked off in the Pakistani capital Islamabad on Saturday. The event brought together political leaders, members of parliament, prominent journalists from different parts of the world, along with delegates from over 15 countries from Asia, Europe, and Africa. The discussions underscored the global solidarity with the Palestinian cause and the necessity of unified diplomatic efforts to address the crisis. While condemning U.S. President Donald Trump's recent proposal to forcibly displace the people of Gaza, the participants unanimously vowed to protect the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the Palestinian territory.
It's a non-serious statement, and nobody in the world is taking it seriously. It's shameful for a U.S. president to talk in violation of the international law. He should be upholding the integrity of the international law.
The international community and the Muslim and all the world states should stand up with the Palestinians for this issue because it is an occupied soil. This is not the soil of the United States or another country.
Participants engaged in the in-depth discussions on year-long violence in Gaza, Israel's continued military aggression, and the urgent need for international intervention to rebuild Gaza after months of destruction by the regime.
Palestinians have their own plans of how they want to reconstruct Gaza. It's just that we need to give that encouragement, and we need to prepare that platform, maybe at the United Nations, maybe at OIC, but Malaysia playing that role. I think we are now together working with Japan for a reconstruction plan for Gaza.
The conference also paid tribute to the martyred journalists of Gaza along with the martyrs of the resistance who kept the cause of Palestinian liberation alive through their sacrifices.
Participants at the International Palestine Conference highlighted the dire humanitarian conditions in Gaza, urging world leaders, including those in Muslim-majority nations, to take concrete steps toward rebuilding Gaza and making serious diplomatic efforts to counter Israeli aggression. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Iran has confirmed that it is indirectly in contact with the new administration in Syria. Iranian Foreign Minister's Special Envoy for Syria, Mohammad Reza Shehbani, said that Tehran has received messages from the new government in Damascus. He said Tehran has a forward-looking approach vis-a-vis developments in Syria and seeks restoration of ties with Damascus. Shehbani also noted that Iran is closely and patiently monitoring the status quo in Syria and will take its appropriate decisions in due time. He underlined the need for all Syrian political parties to have a role in shaping Syria's future. The top Iranian diplomat's announcement came after remarks by Syria's acting foreign minister, Assad Hassan al-Shibani, about the exchange of positive messages between the two Muslim states. With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The limelight.
According to an October 2024 report issued by the International Labour Organization, the unemployment rate in Gaza had risen to nearly 80% during the Zionist regime genocide, and the gross domestic product had been reduced by almost 85%. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, 15-year-old Mahmoud Saleh never imagined that he would one day pull a cart intended for a donkey to earn income for his family. But after his father was killed in an Israeli regime military attack on his carpentry workshop in Gaza City in August 2023, and Saleh's donkey died in a subsequent shelling, he felt he had no other option. Saleh had been forced to flee with his mother, two younger brothers, and two sisters to the Al-Mawasi area of Khan Yunis, carrying with him memories of loss and the burdens of poverty. He did not want his mother earning money by washing other people's clothes by hand, as she had been doing, to the power outages since the Zionist regime's attacks began on October 7, 2023. Saleh borrowed money from an uncle to buy a donkey-drawn cart and used it to transport water to the camps for around $11 a day. With the donkey now dead, Saleh ties a rope around his waist every morning around 7 and pulls the cart loaded with water to the camps for the displaced.
We'll be right back.
During a short break from his work on January 11th, Saleh said, "The young men and passerby often take pity on me and help me push the cart from the back. I wish I could be in school with my friends now, but I have become a man before my time." He said, "I don't have the luxury of dreams. All I think about is how to feed my mother and my younger siblings. But due to the destruction caused by the Israeli regime attacks, it is doubtful that there would be a non-home-based school for Saleh and his friends to go to, even if he had the time to attend classes. At least 625,000 students in the Gaza Strip have been deprived of resuming their education, according to UN experts, as more than 80% of Gaza's schools have been destroyed or damaged in the Zionist regime's attacks. Isa Al-Khati, a displaced resident in Nuseirat, also pulls a card with his hands to earn money. He transports goods and passengers in and around the town's main market in the central Gaza Strip. Al-Khatib said he used to work in construction in the north, but after the Zionist regime's attacks began, he and his family were displaced in May 2023 and he needed new work. With his savings, Al-Khatib bought a horse and a cart and began transporting passengers and goods in Nuseirat. However, the death of his horse in a traffic accident forced him to take its place. Al-Khatib told the Electronic Intifada, "The horse used to save me this suffering. Now I feel like I'm slowly dying every day while pulling this cart." He said he could not afford to buy another horse. Al-Khatib said, "Before the war, a horse cost about $600, and today its price has reached $3,000. Business is slow," he said, "in part because many people see he's taking the place of a horse as degrading, but he insisted he had little choice." Al-Khatib said, "Sometimes passerby take pity on me and give me some money for the free." The unemployment rate in Gaza had risen to nearly 80% during the Zionist regime genocide, and the gross domestic product has been reduced by almost 85%, according to an October 2024 report issued by the International Labour Organization. Ismail Thawabta, director of the government media office, told the Electronic Intifada, "Israel's prevention of fuel from entering Gaza has caused a comprehensive humanitarian disaster." He said that this humanitarian disaster has taken the form of the breakdown of vehicles, forcing residents to resort to primitive means such as carts as primary means of transportation. He said, "What is even more painful is that this war has forced many young men and children to work pulling these carts after losing their animals due to repeated Israeli raids. This, in turn, increases their physical and psychological suffering." Thawabta called on the international community to pressure the Zionist regime to stop its aggressive policies and allow the urgent entry of fuel to avoid further deterioration in the lives of Palestinians in Gaza.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day. When so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, from the last time or session onwards, we started discussing some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And we'd like to continue that in this episode. And my first question is about network marketing. You know that in the modern day and age, well, lots of people have gotten into or landed their, somehow found their jobs in this kind of industry. I mean, network marketing. So what's the jurisprudential law about network marketing transactions? Are the transactions halal? Is the money which is gained or obtained from network marketing okay?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, this is a very interesting question because it is a current legal issue,
mm-hmm.
which has been dealt by some scholars in modern time, of course.
Yes.
Some scholars have no idea what these transactions are like and how they are conducted and what they involve, mm-hmm. you see. But of course, when it comes to the answers given by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, he has quite a clear picture of what these things might involve.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, we see that some scholars have not even responded, have not replied to such questions. They say that, okay, since we do not have a clear idea about it, we ask our followers to follow another mujtahid, mm-hmm. okay? Another mujtahid who has a fatwa, yes. So Ayatollah Khamenei has a fatwa in this regard.
Mm-hmm.
He says that, okay, if the transactions are carried out and based on halal things,
yes.
like it does not involve wine, it does not involve, for example, pork, okay,
mm-hmm.
then there's no problem. But there are certain requirements and conditions which must be fulfilled. For example, number one, he says that no entrance fee is charged. When a person gets into the network transaction, he should not be supposed to pay any money for that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and but there's no problem if someone pays money for getting some kind of instruction or knowledge or education. Okay,
mm-hmm.
because he pays it for the education, not for entering the transaction. That's number one. And number two is that the earnings of the participants or maybe the parties to the transaction must be specified exactly. It should not be something vague or ambiguous or, it should not be based on if and but, because it's not clear, okay? So the earning must be specified, okay? He should have a certain portion or amount of receive a certain portion of money every month. And that shows that the transaction is transparent and the parties involved have specific, for example, income or revenue from the transaction.
Sheikh Javid, when you sign a contract, you normally work on the percentages.
Yes.
Like you say, for example, this much percentage should go to this guy and the other one or the other party,
Yeah.
But even despite that transparency you talked about, as far as the contract is concerned, it is not possible to, let's say, keep that constant, given the situation of the economy today.
Yeah.
Sometimes it goes up and down because of the fluctuations, because of the inflation, and so many other factors involved or at work, right?
Yes.
So what about that scenario? Like, you can't control that, for example, percentage to keep it constant.
You're right.
It's moving. It's changing.
You are very right. I would say that all these scenarios must be studied by the parties and the these considerations must be observed, and then the earning based on these, let's say, fluctuations or ups and downs must be, there should be a kind of estimation probably. Then I would say that then also it's necessary that that the parties carry out actually some kind of reasonable and legitimate activity. Okay, if for example someone simply let's say enters a transaction, he does not do any certain activity, and he receives something without doing any work, that's illicit. That is forbidden.
I see.
Because it's a it's considered to be one of the illegal or unlawful sources of income. Okay, and we should understand that some of the transactions carried out on the space or maybe on the network, on this marketing network, are very much fraudulent.
I see.
And this is the number of fraudulent transactions are more than the number of the halal and permissible transactions. It's much necessary to know how the nature of the transactions, and then with consciousness, with prior knowledge, one should enter this transaction.
Thank you very much, Shavit. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Shahid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, a lot of time such happens that, you know, we have guests, we receive guests, and sometimes the guests come and go, but sometimes the guests like come like once in a lifetime. Yes. You know, we had one of these guests, and this individual left a device in our house, and although you know, that individual was supposed to come back or return and pick it up, but never showed up, you know. And a long time passed, and now we don't have any kind of access to that guest. So what's the religious law about this?
Well, there are two choices. And the first choice is to keep it as long as the person wishes to keep. So that maybe if he happens to come back and turn up, he can pick it up, and of course the property may be in that time returned to him. But if that is not possible, and if someone loses all hope of his returning or and picking it up, then he can give it as sadaqah or charity on his behalf. And of course, he will earn the reward. The reward. The person who left, the guest who left his property or something, item, will earn the reward for that thing which was given to the poor on his behalf.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take another break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on iranradio.ir. Stay with us.
اللهم صل على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio. IR with me, Mohammad Javad, hosting this program, and Ashraf Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Ashraf Javid, let me ask you a question regarding, ask for the calculation of khums on the consumer goods. Well, we know that most of business people, write their economic logbooks based on a fiscal year.
Yeah.
And same is true, actually, with the mu'mineen and Muslims that, keep a very tight and a strict logbook for their khums, for example, or even zakat,
yes,
when it comes to it, based on their khums year, right? Or fiscal year, kind of. Well, how is this khums calculated on the khums goods or consumer goods left at home at the beginning of the khums year, such as rice, oil, tea, sugar, detergents, etc., etc.?
Well, of course, if it is one of the goods that can be procured as much as you need, like, for example, you buy, let's say, 5 kilos or 5 bags of rice or beans and so on and so forth, then the remaining amount is subject to khums. And generally speaking, khums is payable on anything that exceeds the annual expenses of yourself and your family.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And meat, for example, rice, beans, all of these things can be subject to khums if they exceed the annual expenses
mm-hmm.
of yourself and your family. His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei has said that if it comes in packed form, like we know, the for example, beans can be packed and unpacked, okay?
Mm.
If it comes in packed form and the required quantity is purchased in the packed form, he says that what remains from the pack is not subject to khums.
Mm.
This is what His Eminence is stated in his Jawatul Istiftaat.
I see.
But the thing is that, generally speaking, other scholars, other maraji have said that, okay, whatever exceeds the annual mm-hmm. expenses of yourself and of your family, khums should be paid from the extra amount, from the extra rice or meat or whatever. Provided that, like, for example, you talked about detergents, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Detergents. Now, when it comes to detergents, some scholars have said that, okay, if it has market value, it can be sold, for example, on the market, can be taken back to the market and sold as a vendor. You take it and sell it at the side of the road, and people buy it from you, then it has market value. Khums mm. should be paid from it.
And does it depend on the kind of calendar you work with? Because some people work with lunar calendar, some solar, some Gregorian calendar, depending on where you reside, I mean, which country you live in. Because the solar calendar or the Gregorian calendar has 10 days more than the lunar year.
You're right.
So does it depend on the kind of calendar?
Well, the scholars have showed some kind of leniency in this regard.
Uh-huh.
They said that, okay, it depends on you, for example. If you want to set the beginning of Muharram
mm-hmm.
as the first day of your khums, that's okay.
That's the lunar calendar.
That's the lunar calendar. And if you, for example, choose the 21st of March, which is the Nowruz day, for example, as the first day of your khums, again, the scholars have said that's okay, that's fine with the religious authorities and the teachings of Islam.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. Thank you, my dear listeners, for joining us, your own program, Islamic Laws, on iranradio.ir. With me, Muhammad Javad, the host of this program, will bid you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
mother, don't cry for me. I'm heading off to war. God Almighty is my armor and sword. Palestine, forever Palestine. Children being killed for throwing stones in the sky. They say to their parents, don't worry, God is on our side. Palestine, forever Palestine. Mother, don't worry when they come for us at night. Surely they'll be sorry when God puts them right. Tell me why they do it, what was done to them. Children of Palestine are fighting for our lives. They say to their parents, we know that Palestine is our right. They say to their parents, we'll fight for what is right. They say not to worry, God is on our side. Die for Palestine, Palestine, forever
Palestine. In the limelight.
As the U.S. and the Zionist regime ramp up their assault, the resistance, rooted deeply in the will of the Lebanese and Palestinian people, stands as a bulwark against their malevolent ambitions. But the cost of this fight will be steep, and the consequences of underestimating the resilience of those who stand against them will be felt for years to come. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for the second part. Press TV wrote, as the battlefield shifted from Palestine to Lebanon, the United States pursued its long-standing goal of removing Hezbollah from both the political and military arenas. With the rogue Israeli regime campaign targeting Hezbollah leaders, the U.S. ambassador to Lebanon ominously told the country to prepare for a post-Hezbollah era. The words echoed Condoleezza Rice's hollow promises of a new Middle East, a vision of dominance and subjugation that Ortega's now appears determined to realize. Ortega's words, insulting and provocative as they were, seem to be a thinly veiled call for war, And in this charged moment, she didn't stop at rhetoric. As she stood in Baba Palace, flashing her Star of David ring during a handshake photo with the Lebanese president, her very presence served as a reminder to the Lebanese people that the imposition of U.S.-Israeli settler colonial will be coming with full force. For decades, USAID and Ford Foundation-funded initiatives aimed at socially engineering Hezbollah out of Lebanese society have faltered. Despite these efforts, Hezbollah's strong ideological foundation, rooted in political education and the cultural strengths of the Shia community, has proven resilient. Through the teachings of martyred leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah has fostered a deep sense of resistance, one that has withstood even the most intense U.S. ideological conditioning campaigns. The battle for Lebanon's soul is far from over, and as the U.S. pushes forward with its aggressive agenda, the Lebanese people's resolve grows even stronger. It was evident again. And election results were indeed a slap in the face to Ortega's, with Hezbollah and Amal both winning 5 seats in the new government, including the Ministry of Finance. Hezbollah earned 2 of these positions, including the Ministries of Labor and Displaced, respectively. Where the U.S. and Israel sought to engineer a crisis in resistance leadership, they found themselves entangled in a crisis of their own. While the occupation sends its diminishing grip on borders, it now strives to destabilize Lebanon from both the north and south, aiming to overwhelm Hezbollah once Israel's self-proclaimed ceasefire extension expires. This ceasefire, already violated 1,000 times by the Zionist regime, is slowly eroding the resistance patience. A temporary pause in hostilities meant to reposition attacks on Hezbollah from every angle. What began with the fall of Syria to Western-backed Takfiri militants has evolved into a deadly escalation, with the clock ticking toward Israel's February 18 deadline. These militants, aligned with the U.S. and Israel's agenda, now stir chaos by clashing with Lebanese clans in Baalbek and attempting border infiltrations in the northeast, threatening to reintroduce violence into Lebanon. Meanwhile, the Lebanese army has been explicitly taught to avoid interference in these U.S.-led schemes, leaving the resistance to fend for itself as it faces mounting pressure on all sides. To the south, the Zionist regime's efforts to reclaim territory south of the Litani River are increasingly evident. Booby-trapping homes of resistance fighters, planting surveillance devices, and imposing security belts, all these are precursors to an expanded occupation. Since the ceasefire was put into effect, the Zionist regime has violated it nearly 1,000 times across Lebanon, using this so-called calm period to terrorize southern and Beqa communities. This is more than a political maneuver. It's an all-out assault on the very heart of the resistance. Attacking resistance members and their families in such brutal ways is a final, desperate attempt to wipe out the organization, targeting each individual and their loved ones in a bid to dismantle the resistance entirely. As the Zionist regime and the U.S. tighten their grip, future attacks will not stop at bombs and bullets. The battle is shifting into the digital sphere as tech giants like Trump, Musk, and big tech consolidate power to further weaponize technology against resistance societies in both Palestine and Lebanon. What began as a form of psychological warfare is now escalating into full-fledged social engineering, with the tech community's sudden pivot from liberal discourse to neoconservative rhetoric, signaling a broader shift in strategy, one that seeks to achieve goals through coercion now that consent has proven unattainable. Google, for example, quietly backed away from its commitment to prevent its technology from being used as an instrument of warfare and surveillance. Gaza's AI-powered genocide marked the loudest signal of big tech's transformation from a tool of soft warfare into a weapon of hot war. The U.S., too, has been openly and brazenly tearing up international agreements and dismantling the facade of rule of law. The previous U.S. administration's unconditional funding of genocide in Gaza has further exposed the hollowness of their claims to uphold human rights. Now, with the masks and gloves fully off, the stage is set for more attacks on phones, homes, and lives under the leadership of a president who ran on promises of peace while accepting millions from notorious war profiteers like Sheldon Adelson. As the United States and the Zionist regime ramp up their assault, the resistance, rooted deeply in the will of the Lebanese and Palestinian people, stands as a bulwark against their malevolent ambitions. But the cost of this fight will be steep, and the consequences of underestimating the resilience of those who stand against them will be felt for years to come. Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israeli drone strike kills 3 civilians in southern Lebanon in another blatant violation of the ceasefire agreement with the Arab country. Thousands of protesters take to the streets across the occupied territories, calling on the Israeli regime to complete the captive exchange deal with Hamas. And Israeli forces attack the houses of recently freed Palestinian abductees as the regime steps up its crackdown on Palestinians across the occupied West Bank. Thank you for joining us. The Israeli regime has committed fresh violations of the ceasefire deal with Lebanon, killing and injuring a number of civilians in the southern part of the country. According to the Lebanese media, an Israeli drone targeted a vehicle on the Jarjou Road in the Iqlim Al-Tufa area, killing 3 Lebanese civilians and injuring 4 others. The report added that the drone fired a guided missile at the civilian vehicle. Another car was caught in the blast radius of the explosion, injuring 4 women. The regime claimed that the attack targeted a senior member of the Hezbollah resistance movement. The ceasefire entered into force last November after more than a year of Israeli aggression on Lebanon. It obligated Israel to withdraw from southern Lebanon over a 60-day period, but the regime refused to fulfill its obligations and the deadline was extended until February 18th. Israel has repeatedly violated the deal, and its strikes have killed and injured many Lebanese civilians. Thousands of protesters have taken to the streets in several areas across the occupied territories, demanding the completion of the captive exchange deal with Hamas. In Tel Aviv, demonstrators protested the regime's ceasefire violations and obstructions. They called on the regime's cabinet to complete the captive exchange deal. Similar protests were held in the Haifa area and the Lower Galilee. Gaza-based resistance groups have repeatedly complained about Israel's violations, threatening to halt the deal. Since the beginning of the Israeli genocide in Gaza, the regime's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has been blamed for mishandling the war by protesters who have repeatedly called on him to resign. The first phase of the Gaza ceasefire deal is to last 42 days. The two sides are yet to negotiate the second phase of the agreement. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has published a video of its most recent release of Israeli captives held in Gaza. The footage shows Gaza resistance fighters handing 3 Israeli captives over to the Red Cross. Resistance fighters paraded the captives onto a stage in Gaza's southern city of Khan Yunis, where the Israelis addressed the crowd before the handover. The 3 men warned Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that time is running out and urged the Israeli cabinet to adhere to the completion of further exchanges of captives under the ceasefire deal. The Israeli captives were released on Saturday. Buses carrying the freed Palestinians have arrived at Khan Yunis as the 6th stage of the prisoners' exchange deal between the Hamas resistance movement and the Israeli regime is carried out. To document their arrival, our Gaza correspondent Abu Bakr Abed went to the European hospital where he talked to some of the freed Gazans.
A moment of joy, a moment of happiness, as 333 Palestinian detainees have arrived from Israeli jails in the European hospital in Khan Yunis. After experiencing every sort of torture and enduring unthinkable horrors, some have been blindfolded and beaten for weeks, others were left in cages like animals,